This week on RSBNB Update, the first Yak Track of 2020 is here. We go through the rewards, and a majority of the cosmetics are on the free track, which we like. We also learn more about the archaeology rewards, and then we have a roundup of all the lore that you need to be aware of heading into archaeology. This is RSBNB Update, episode 770, recorded Thursday, March 26th, 2020. The Zodiac is back. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of RSBNB Update. Just Tanis and myself here once again this week. Fun little busy week, isn't it, this week, as we ramp up, only days away at this point from the archaeology launch as we sit here and we record this later on Thursday.
Dude, I'm amped up.
Yeah.
Hyped.
Yeah,
hyped.
We're definitely getting there after what we saw in the live stream this week. And, you know, tomorrow, Friday, by the time you guys are hearing this, they will have played through the tutorial experience on stream, and that'll give everybody the first true taste of how the skill is going to work. But oh boy, is it looking amazing in that regard. And you know, we actually have something on archaeology just a little bit later in the podcast. In addition to the live stream, we have an archaeology lore roundup, and you know, you're probably wondering what's that about. Well, just to put it mildly, we, Diana and myself, went through all five of the lore journals. We provided a brief summary on them and provided some extra contextual information around them in terms of what would have been happening in the RuneScape world at the time and just how exactly that works. So that'll be coming up after we talk about the live stream from this week. And that was a fun little sub-episode in that. So hopefully you guys will enjoy that. But I am Shane12088 and he is Tanis79, and we're gonna go over what would be another favorite update of mine, the second Yak Track.
Ooh,
I absolutely love these things.
This is the first premiere track I could do, so
right?
Loving it. Yeah, totally loving it.
Yeah. You know, I always underestimate the power of these things because it got me doing dungeoneering, for God's sakes.
Oh, jeez. Okay, well, yeah, that's quite powerful.
It really is. It really is. Because there was one of the tasks that needed seven dungeons to be done, and, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of dungeoneering. I got to have a nice, competent group of friends around me so we can kind of laugh through it, that kind of thing in that regard. Should we talk about tasks or rewards first? What do you want to deal with first in this?
Let's do our chores, Shane.
All right.
Do our chores
tasks.
Before we get rewards.
Well, you know, one of the biggest complaints that I heard about this, and that was heard about the last one that came out, you know, same time as 120 farming and 120 herb lore, is that people wanted to focus on those 120s when they came out, and really in that way missed, you know, maybe a week or two of time to do Yak Track when they were instead focusing in on the new farming and herb lore updates. Well, with this, there's 25 archaeology tasks that are going to go live next week in this Yak Track. So there's 50 tasks in total, and you're going to be able to do 25 of them with archaeology next week. 25.
Yeah, this was they really took the criticism and made this better. I mean, and we liked it first time around.
Yeah. To be fair, last time I didn't feel it was that big of an issue, because I already had 120 in both, so I was just kind of exploring around the edges, and I wasn't really in a rush to level from 99 to 120 in those skills.
Yeah, it's just that it's nice to have, like, you want those things to be kind of concurrent, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If you can. And I don't, I think the other thing is, I don't feel that it's as grindy in nature.
Yeah, well, let's go through some of these. The first one is to talk to Sir Yactric Morin Berthorpe, or do something archaeology-related, which we don't know yet. The second one is to either chop or mine 120 willow or coal and above. And the interesting part about this is you can mix and match. So if you wanted to go chop yews for 60, you could do that. Or if you instead wanted to go mine some bainite ore, you could do that instead. And you can mix and match.
Yeah, I like that.
And this is the point in which the show that I'll just say that divine locations are phenomenal for these resource gathering ones. I'll just put that out there. That's something that I learned on the last Yak Track. And if you're wanting to fish rocktails quickly, well, there you go. Use some divine locations and then just top the rest up with something else. And, you know, these early tasks are, you know, willow or coal. And, you know, those are fairly low-leveled ores and wood in this case. So it's not throwing you straight off the deep end and telling you to go mine something like phasmatite or magic logs, right? So it eases us into it nicely. We have a choice of catching 100 raw fish, salmon or above, and then the other option task beyond that is for rune crafting, 405 craft or siphon chaos runes and above. Another great use here for the power burst of sorcery to double your rune crafting multiplier. If you have level 91 rune crafting, you get double natures, you can make that times 4 and complete this rather quickly with one pouch load and then the essence that you get from the Wicked Hood. So that's what I did for that one. Yeah, power burst of sorcery. People were saying there'd never be a use for that, but there it is. The next one is cooking or fletching, and this one was a bit of a, oh my god, 715 pike or oak shortbows and above. Or a task B being archaeology, which we don't have yet.
Yeah, going to wait for archaeology.
Yeah. Then, you know, there's another one following this. Bring 12 eggs to Benedict and Varrock, or take 28 astral runes to Simon in the wilderness. And then task 6, this is where I am, make, you ready for this? Mm-hmm. 770 super anti-poison potions or above. Or complete 6 dungeon floors.
Oh, that's why.
Of a cult and above. See?
Yeah. I mean, you could do that with I guess it wouldn't be as good as for dailies, but...
Yeah, and I mean, it's a lot slower, too, the potions than the dungeoneering, probably, I'd say. I think the average potion rate is somewhere around 1,400, 1,500 an hour, so you're looking at a half hour. And each of these dungeons that it did, and, you know, I was just looking at a way of completing this task the quickest I did, so I just did smalls, so I was done in, you know, like 10-15 minutes on this. Because, you know, 2 minutes and change for these, sometimes less. We won't go through all the tasks here. I'll just take us up to task 10. Task 7 is prayer smithing, bury remains or smith items of impious ashes or higher, and mithril bars are above and higher. The other task B is archaeology. Task 8 is to complete 4 slayer tasks or mine 325 coal and above. Then here's one of my favorite ones, the farming tasks that always come in. Harvest 20 tomatoes or above. Or fletch and string 500 oak shortbows and above.
So I like this and above. It's like it gives you a baseline, but you could do whatever.
Yeah, whatever you're comfortable range. With. And then task 10 is 735 salmon or raw pike in terms of cooking or fishing. So this is actually really neat because you just divide that number in half right there, right? And then you can, you know, fish half of them and then cook the rest and your task is done, which is something you could not do last time.
Yeah, that's cool.
So 367, you know, let's just say you wanted to go for lobsters or monkfish for some reason, cook them and away you go. Then the task B is archaeology. Then we got, you know, these archaeology tasks are just peppered in here practically every second or third task going all the way through this list. And, you know, I think that really highlights here the purpose of what they've done. And we'll have to see what some of these numbers are, because, you know, task 33 is thieving or fire making, pickpocketing, you know, watchmen or magic lugs and above, and you have to do 3,000 of those. So the question for that is, will the archaeology task be easier than that? Harvest plants, avocado and above. And I'm just picking and choosing here from the entire list, but the task list is pretty much the same thing. They're, you know, I wouldn't even call these grindy, would you?
No.
No.
Not at all.
No. And I mean, the question that comes up, and the reason I asked that question, because, you know, there was a discussion in clan chat about if this was grindy, and, you know, the instant retort to this was, well, I mean, it's an MMO. There's always going to be a nature of grind in what you do. But just looking at the numbers that we have here for these, they're not something that's going to keep you going on for days in and days out. These are, in most cases, bite-sized content that you're going to finish after, you know, 1 or 2 hour-long play sessions, if that's how you play the game.
So I don't even think, like, I haven't heard any of these that should take anywhere even near that long.
No. I mean, collect 1,000 bright energy above. That's number 12. Tent Slayer tasks or Dungeoneering floors at task 17. And see, this is the split again, because let's just say you did, you know, 3 Slayer tasks in a day and then you went Dungeoneering with your friends. Oh, there we go. Task 17 complete, rather than, you know, just doing 10 Slayer tasks in a row.
Right. Yeah.
I really like the way this has been split out. I do have to say that.
Well, that right there reduces the grind, right? Like, you're not locked in to where you have to keep doing it until you're finished.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that goes a long way right there.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I'm just looking to see if there's anything that's truly asinine on here. Summoning or cooking, 5,890. Swamp Titans or fish oil and above. That doesn't seem too bad. I mean, if you do the cooking side of it, of course, right? Because, I mean, 5,800 summoning pouches would be a lot.
Yeah, maybe an hour.
But that one has a task B of archaeology again.
Yeah, see, and I'm going to pick archaeology every
What people need to remember with this is that this is designed around archaeology. So we're not going to see stuff in here that says, oh, you need, you know, level 80 plus archaeology to do this task. Because people aren't going to be there when this is being focused at least the vast majority of the player base. It ain't going to be there.
Right.
I'm really interested to see what the levels on the archaeology tasks are going to be. And we'll see that next week. Are you at all concerned that by working on Yak Track this week, you might miss out on doing some archaeology tasks?
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah, like, I think that's the only thought that's gone through my head, that's like, oh, maybe I should hold off on doing these until archaeology comes out and just focus on doing some other prep-related things instead.
Yeah, I think it was decent timing for it. I'm waiting for the big push. So I've been going light this week anyway.
And you know what the most beautiful side of this is? There's an entire different task list for free to play. That was just the members' tasks.
See, that's cool. Well, and I'll even be able to get a taste of archaeology, right? Because not go up to
this
20,
goes up to 20.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's cool.
Let's see if they have any archaeology tasks. I'm not seeing any. I don't think. No. They don't have archaeology task bees. No, they don't.
Oh, missed opportunity, guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, level 20, right?
Well, yeah, but what if you really liked archaeology and you want to go further than 20?
Then I'd say buy a bond and get membership.
Right.
Anything else on the task before we move on to the rewards?
No, I think that covers it.
All right. That's not COVID, folks. I'm okay. So let's have a look at some of these rewards here. You know, once again, hit it out of the park with the cosmetic rewards on this. And yeah, for anybody wanting to see these, all you have to do is go to the little area in Burthorpe right next to Challenge Mistress Farah, and all the rewards will be on play, on display, all the pets, all the swords, the outfits, some of the little pink furry little animals too. They're all here, and oh my god, these outfits look absolutely amazing. All three of them.
Yeah. They're clean, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And for anybody wondering, we're just admiring here on the video feed of how that looks. I would highly recommend that everybody go and have a look at Burthorpe if you want to see what these look like. If you're at all unsure about how you're going to get on with the ACT track, then you can go and have a look there and see if the fundamentally amazing cosmetics that we have here. Oh my god, I just have to go back here on this one. I'm looking at this, and one of the swords here has an animated texture on it.
Oh, that's cool. Damn.
At least it looks that way when I'm moving past it. Maybe that's just the distortion effect of moving the camera from side to side, but there's definitely some animated effects that we're seeing here on these things. Oh yeah, definitely on the cape. Animated effects everywhere you go. And this is RuneScape 3, folks. That's what I always say. But for anybody wanting a textual representation of what the rewards look like, you know, we could say, you know, that there are other treasure hunter style items on there, but I think everybody expects that when they go into Yak Track, right? Like, there should be no issue with that being here. I have no issue with it.
No, I
and you know, we're talking about this, and for people wondering, there is the free track and the premium track with this, and there's actually one full outfit, the Duskuri Battle Mage outfit and sword, that is actually the reward for task one on the free-to-play track, believe it or not. So just for completing the first task, you get an outfit, even if you do this for free.
Nice.
And then at tier 4, there's another cosmetic on the free track. Tier 10, another cosmetic on the free track. Are you sensing something here? That we have to go to task 12 before we get our first premium cosmetic override.
Really?
And that's the Equus Cape at task 12 on the premium track.
Okay.
Reward 16 is the Duskuri throwing knife, offhand throwing knife, and some medium protein packs and 5 protein power-ups. Equus Sword, task 19. Duskuri Sentinel Pet at task 20. On the free track, and I will say if these are on the premium paid track as well, and the next premium reward is the Pegasus plushie at task 24. So we're practically, for all intents and purposes, going through this reward list, and we get to task 25, and there's only 2 cosmetics on the premium reward track. That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing, because, you know, most games like Fortnite and whatnot, in terms of going out after for their battle pass, they put their cosmetics on the premium track because that's what players play that game for. But here on this Yak Track event, we're up to task 24, and all but 2 or 3 of the cosmetics are on the free and free track.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Let's see. What do we got next? Duskuri Halberd at task 30, free. Equus Shield, 31, premium. Let's see. Where is the next one? Ramhorns, task 36, free. Sheridan Throwing Axe and the Offhand Throwing Axe. That's on task 39 for premium.
Okay.
Equus 1, Task 40, free. Sheraton Orb 43, free. Equus 2-Handed Sword, Task 46, premium. And the Equus Orb, or sorry, I said 2-Handed Sword. I meant at Tier 46, we have the 2-Handed Sword on the premium track. And at Tier 49, we have the Orb on the free track. And then at Tier 50, you get the Cosmic Weaver Teleport, the Stargazer Goggle Cosmetic Override on the free track. And the premium track gets the Sheraton Mercenary Cosmetic Overrides, the Cosmic Billy Pet, the Sheraton Shield Override, and that's it. So it looks like the majority of the cosmetic items, if that's what you're after, are on the free track here. That makes me feel really good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it feels like it's something like 60-40 free to premium from the looks of it here. I haven't actually counted them up, but that's what it feels like to me based on just what we went through. And I don't know if it feels that same way to you.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the other items really are just everything that you'd come to expect. You know, protein power-ups, protein packs, spring, Silverhawk down, lamps, stars, some smoldering lamps here and there, combat dummy crates, and so on and so forth. But those are the rewards for this Yak Track. And, you know, I was expecting that we would see more on the premium track in terms of cosmetics, but it seems they took that feedback also into account as well in terms of making this one much more lucrative for the everyday player, the everyday free player who doesn't want to pick up the premium pass for this, which they said they were going to do, and they delivered on very nicely. So,
I guess this makes sense too, though, right? Because, like, if you're doing the premium, you're getting the free too, right?
Yeah.
So you would give the cosmetic on the free side, and that just makes the premium means you're going to get like one of the protein items, or
Or, you know what I mean? Or like, maybe a couple extra little cosmetic items along the way.
Right. So I guess it makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, this is a great way of doing it. Earlier in the month, Wargaming, who runs World of Tanks, put out their own battle pass kind of system, and you know, all the rewards are useless for that, really, except for the two at the very, very top end of it. And you know, they're just things that you can get in game and makes your performance better. And there's nothing cosmetic in this regard. And I don't know, maybe I'm in the minority on this one from the efficiency side of players, but I am definitely more into this Yak Track stuff for the cosmetics than the other items. How about you?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean,
okay.
Yeah, I think some of the outfits look pretty sharp. Yeah, because the other stuff is fine. I don't think it's like too much or too little. I mean, it's pretty dead on.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I would even go so far as to hold this up as a way to do a battle pass kind of event. You know.
Yeah, this one's pretty good. Like, I think they ironed out the kinks, and I'm looking forward to it. And
yeah, me too.
I'm gonna hold off if I can for archaeology, but
I think I'm gonna go to task 10 before archaeology comes out, then leave the rest. I think that's the way I want to do it for me.
There you go.
So excellent. Alrighty then. Let's move on and talk about the live stream from this week, because there were no patch notes this week. There were just a couple of tiny little fixes in the news post itself, and those are so small I can run through them right now. Total skill level checks or first-time user experience achievements are now a one-off login check, and this should resolve an issue where some players could not log in. Yeah, that's a big one. And dummy objects, as in objects you're not supposed to see, will no longer appear in the Grand Exchange search filters. Excellent.
Okay.
All right. So, live stream. Yes. This was a fun little live stream because they were doing this one entirely remote.
This one was
Mod Porky, cool. Mod Yago, and Mod Orion.
Yeah, and, I like this live stream. And this is my favorite archaeology one.
And I'm just going to highlight something here that I don't know if people might have heard during this live stream. Mod Orion is a maxed 5.4 build character.
Yep.
And Mod Yago is maxed in all of the skills at 200 mil, except for the combat ones. And these are the people you have working on your next skill, which blew me away.
Yeah, I was pretty shocked.
And, you know, there was a question between them, you know, let's take a bet as to who's actually going to get 99 first in this based on, you know, how you treat the rest of the game. And they weren't sure who would win in that. So that kind of highlights the dynamicness of archaeology that we're going to see come Monday. And that's what you said prior to this one, is that this skill just feels so complete that the more we learn about it, the more satisfying it feels, even though we haven't touched it yet.
And just there's more layers and layers on top of layers on top of layers. So we might actually get to see a real choice in what we do.
Uh-huh.
I can't wait. I'm excited.
Well, you know, speaking of choice, we should just start then with the relics. And they showed off the relic system in terms of how that works. And, you know, there was no live demo with it. There were just screenshots on it. But I guess before we dive in too much, I'll just say there was another video that Maud Osborne hosted in the archaeology tent, we'll just call it, with a bunch of people who were coming in looking for rewards. So that's linked in the show notes at update.rsbnb.com. And I'd recommend you give that a watch before we talk about this, because they did premiere that video on this live stream. And for all intents and purposes, the live stream was going through that video. So we're not going to go through that video because it will be covered in the live stream here. So I think we go talk about relics first, right?
Dude, yeah, the relics.
So we don't know what they're all going to be. There's going to be some differences in them than what we saw at RuneFest, which is good because you don't want that entire list that was there to just remain static between now and then. That signifies that change has indeed happened with that. And the way it's been structured is that it costs to activate relics and swap them out in terms of the currency of Chronotes, but you're limited to a maximum of 3 relics online at the same time. But at the very high end of the skill, you'll be only able to have something called 500 monolith energy. And this is what you need to have in order to keep a relic active. Think of this as the energy quota, as it were. And I think that's what it's going to be in the lore when it comes to it at the end of the day. It's more like an energy quota. Is that how you kind of took it?
I kind of looked at it as like the way our machines work.
An invention. Right. As in you have a certain quota and you got to make decisions about what you're going to put where and how that's going to ultimately all fit in together with that. So you pay Chronotes to activate the relic and you give up a certain amount of monolith energy. And as you level up your archaeology skill, you will get more monolith energy available to you. You have 150 at level 1. That goes up to 250 at level 40. And at level 90, it goes up to 500. And that's the max at level 90. Now, whenever you want to swap out a relic, it will cost you Chronotes. And that is going to be made available through the skill itself. And did I hear this wrong, or is this what they actually said in the live stream, is that you'll be able to purchase Chronotes off of other players? Or did I mishear that?
I thought they said relics.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to check that once it
launches.
Because I thought relics were your, I thought relics were your own that you'd discovered.
No, because they're artifacts, right?
Yeah.
The relic is a tradable form of like you got to get an artifact. I thought the relics were
tradable. So you find the artifact and you power it up and you restore it, and then you might be able to get a relic from that, is the sense that I got of how it works here. I might be wrong on that. But, you know, we're not going to dance around mechanics here because we'll all be putting our hands into that come
next
week.
We'll find out Monday.
One of the ones they highlighted was Abyssal Link, which will give free teleports, no runes needed, and no magic XP will be given. There's 26 relics going into game, and each of them are one-time unlocks. And so you unlock it once, and then you got to pay the chrono to activate it.
Okay,
It fits within that energy capacity.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that I that stood out I did hear was it sounded like someone going to be mystery locked. It's like
that's fine.
Yeah, I mean it's okay, but so it looks like you will have to. You will have to do the mystery. So
yeah, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. No, I'm just saying, like you will have to do like little quests.
Yeah,
while you're
that's good.
Scaling.
That's good.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. I could go into why that is, but I feel like we'd be driving a wedge somewhere in the various communities on that. And you know, they were very careful not to reveal what all the relics were, and I think that's good. I think that's a good decision to make on this. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think we got enough of a look at all the different kinds of rewards that I don't know. It was the right balance because now I'm hyped. I'm ready. I'm like, let's go.
Yeah, it is definitely time to go in that regard on there. Because, I mean, they've been working on this since October, I think, of 2018. That's when they did the initial design of it. We first heard there was a big update coming around Christmas of that year. They hyped it, and then it was unveiled in September on that Mod Shawnee live stream where he nearly lost it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And you know what? I was thinking about archaeology, Shane.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I thought about it this live stream. I'm like, you know what? Like, archaeology really is kind of a RuneScape skill.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, how much of the game it was about, you know, this age or that age?
Yeah.
I mean, you remember that when you first start, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, it really fits it's just such a RuneScape kind of skill.
Yeah. And just for clarification on the relics, you find them when you're working through the skill, and they are permanent. I just looked that up.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about relics in that regard, but this is the primary reward system that touches into other skills and other aspects of the game that is going to be persistent throughout all of archaeology. We need to underscore that before we move on to these next ones. And the next
that
part,
also do the same thing.
Huh? What was that?
That also interact with like a bunch of different aspects of the
ancient
game.
Summoning mm-hmm. is the next one. This will be unlocked at the Warforge dig site, which is the Zamorak themed one by the Jolly Borean. And with that, ancient summoning was described as the following way. And you tell me if this reminds you of anything. You go out, you slay a creature, and if you have a contract in your inventory, you can capture that creature and then summon it. They announced three of them so far. One of them was a Hellhound, one of them was a Ripper Demon, and I can't remember what the third one was. Can you?
No, wait. No. Hellhound, the 10% absorb 10% of damage.
Yeah, and the Ripper Demon.
Ripper Demon did an extra attack and that jumpy thing.
What was the other one? In any case, are you feeling something here?
That it's basically another Slayer kind of codex still?
Sure.
Like the Ushabi? Yeah.
Sure.
But it's
this
also
is
what we've been advocating for not being
for summoning for a long time, making not the pouch making skill.
Right, now that's what I remains to be seen, right? Because that all depends on, well, how much XP are we talking?
Yeah.
And is that going to be turning summoning into like a combat? Basically, you're getting XP through combat for summoning.
Right.
So I just wanted to see where that's at because I don't know.
And I think that's perfect.
Who knows?
Honestly, I think that's perfect. You know why? Because I don't know if you were around for this. Were you around for the run-up to the summoning skill?
I wasn't.
Okay. That skill was teased, in the way that Jagex typically did that back in the day of bringing out a skill. And, you know, it was marketed as a combat skill so much so to the point is, you know, it added another 8 levels onto the combat formula. Or sorry, another 12 levels onto the combat formula to 138 from 126. And everybody starts training it, and it's pouch making, right?
Yeah.
And we're saying, how is this combat related? Because you get token XP for using your familiars in combat. And I feel that this is the way summoning should have always been. And I think this is a bit of a field test, in a way, to see if they could take summoning to 120.
I think we'll
with
see
a different mechanic.
I feel there's one thing missing, though.
Okay.
There's one big thing missing. Or maybe it ain't missing. Maybe we just don't know yet until it drops on Monday. But it needs – I really feel like it needs some kind of a charm-like item. It can't just be killing in this contract. Which – and I don't even know how you get this contract. Like, I don't know how plentiful they are. I don't know how easy they are to get. But I feel like there should be something –
that really wasn't talked about, I don't think.
It wasn't, but there should be some kind of, I don't know, I feel like there should be some kind of charm, unless using the charms is like pre-99 training, and then this is meant to replace a post-99 level training.
Well, no, it's not.
Until we see those numbers.
It's not, because they start at 45 and go all the way to 96.
Well, yeah.
Summoning.
Right, yeah.
The Hellhound takes 10% of the damage directed towards the player and can heal itself on it. So they said it's a damage sponge. The Ripper Demon does its famous Ripper Demon attack and does 300% damage on your target. And they didn't really elaborate on what else that we would have in here, just that there would be at least 2 other familiars in here that are not combat related, and that you'd be making a decision if you bring a Ripper Demon or a Steel Titan, because the Ripper Demon can double slash.
Yeah, I'm gonna say. I mean, you're gonna take that every time, right?
Yeah.
But they did say there was some non-combat related ones.
Yeah,
so
they didn't highlight on what it was though, but there was definitely at least 2 in that range.
So I mean, I'm curious about that too.
Well, it's a good time to have 96 summoning.
If you don't have it, you need to won't get it.
If you want that Ripper Demon. And they said
thank goodness those are tradable.
That's true. These ancient summoning pouches are tradable. So if you don't want to interact with archaeology and you just want the Ripper Demon, you'll be able to find someone out there who is doing
that.
You
can make money with summoning.
Yeah, we're going to get to that about ancient inventions soon. And they said also with this is that it's expected that in the future they will expand on both the ancient relics and summoning familiars to add more of them.
Yeah,
so these are, just locked in state forever. And this unlocks at Warforge. So you're going to need – I probably have that somewhere on my – list here from the
68
Warf. Yeah, I had this set up from our previous discussion on this. Warforge is 76. That's ancient summoning. Where did I say this damn thing unlocked at the Jolly Bar Inn? I was thinking of something else. This one unlocks at Warforge. Sorry. Warforge, not the Jolly Bar Inn. I was thinking of our lore perspective on that one with Zamorak, which you'll hear about in just a bit. Okay. And it makes sense why they would want to put this one in the Bandos area of Warforge, right?
Yeah.
So. All right. Should we move on to Ancient Invention?
Yeah. Get ready, PVM. Get ready.
I love this. I love this part of it. And, you know, maybe it's because this is kind of what we were told would happen with this at the end of the day. Or no, I'm sorry. I typoed that. It is indeed the Infernal Source at the Jolly Bar Inn where you unlock Ancient Summoning. I must have been copying on cruise control when I was typing these notes up.
About 68?
No, way earlier than that.
Okay.
40, or sorry, 20.
Oh. Okay.
20. Infernal Source is 20.
I knew something didn't
add up there because I saw something in my notes, but that's not what I heard on the stream. So I'm glad I double checked that. Okay, Ancient Invention. This one unlocks at the Stormguard Citadel. Okay. And the reason that's a big okay there is because I feel this is what Invention was always supposed to be like in terms of the technology, because this is technology from the God Wars era. You'll unlock four new components with it.
It's almost like a third type of, like a third batch.
Third batch of Invention. Yeah. You'll unlock the four components are Classic, Historic, Time-Worn, and Vintage. And you'll be able to get them from disassembling archaeology-based materials, including relics. Or, so they said, don't start disassembling early on. And this ore is very big.
Or.
I assume you're very excited about this.
I guess. But yeah.
You'll be able to craft material crates.
Mm-hmm.
And sell these crates on the exchange. I think the numbers they said were they come in packages of 100 or 1,000. You'll just be able to purchase them and box them up in a way they go on the exchange. And the reason they did this is because the way it works with other Invention materials is that those items are in-game already. But with this one, these ones are purely archaeology related. So they're attacking it from the reverse side of it. And, you know, I think this is going to be good because what they're being very careful to do is they're being very careful to make it so that if you still want to do Ancient Invention, you can do that. And, you know, you need to, of course, be able to, you know, unlock it at the Stormguard Citadel, which I think is level 70, if I remember correctly. And following that, if you don't want to do archaeology beyond there, you can just buy the materials. I think that's good. We'll have to see how it goes market-wise. I think this is the big market question mark, perhaps. We don't know how it's going to interact with the rest of the skill. Not disassembling relics, disassembling restored artifacts at higher levels. And here's a big one. There's blueprint fragments that you can find at the Stormguard Citadel to create a few blueprints for, like, the ancient gizmos and whatnot. But it works exactly like the Surge and Escape from Anachronia. There's going to be tradable versions you can make of the blueprint and non-tradable versions you can make. So if you're doing archaeology and you love archaeology, but you have zero interest in doing Invention, you can make a tradable version with the materials you get and sell that on the exchange.
Interesting.
What was that?
I thought it's interesting.
Yeah. I think that's good because this goes into the whole thing that they don't want to lock people into a specific playstyle. You're free to effectively jump on or get off wherever you want on this train, so to speak.
Well, and you need something once you're once you max the skill out, right? Like, what are you going to do with artifacts that you've restored if you're already, if you're 99 or 120 or what have you?
Yeah.
You got to have something to do with them.
We saw three new perks in the live stream that they showed off: Ruthless, Fortune, and Relentless. We don't know what they do, but there's going to be more than that.
Get ready, PV.
With the gizmo slots being 9 now instead of 5 with these, the ancient gizmo slots, there's going to be many more possibilities with this. And, you know, some of these have been teased before online, and the PVM community has been salivating at these. So, what was the one they were salivating at? I think it was it the crackling one, or was it a different one?
Probably.
I don't remember exactly what it was, but I know the PVM community was salivating at one of them. And, you know, I think the biggest thing we need to take away from this, and the lore around this one's going to be interesting, is that this is Armadil's technology, or at least the Armadilian followers' technology from the God Wars, up in the sky somewhere, miles up in the sky.
See, does that create some plot questions, though? Because if they had that...
Well, that's what the lore drops are going to answer.
If they had that good of technology, shouldn't they have won? Like, hands down, you know?
I don't know. And, you know, we're going to hear more about that in the lore at Stormguard Citadel, I bet. But that's Ancient Invention. And you can tell that we could spend a whole episode on each of these: Ancient Summoning, Ancient Invention. That's what we aim to do as we work our way through the archaeology-related episodes.
Yeah, dude. I mean, just think of all the possibilities for PVM. But there's probably going to be all kinds of possibilities for skilling too, like. The relics are showing. I mean, there's already.
It's a great time to be playing RuneScape.
Like it seems like this skill is going to tie in with just about everything, every major thing that people like to do. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's going to be a farming aspect somewhere.
Well, I mean, I'll put that in skilling, right?
Yeah, but you know. Farming and Herblore were just updated, so it's going to be a question if they want to do that so soon to add on to it, but we'll see.
I mean, who knows? Maybe you can dump some of that soil. Maybe give it a little fertilizer.
That's actually something else I wanted to mention next, is that in the video they showed something called an auto screener version 1.080 or 1080, hence the 1080 screened, that's going to automatically screen your soil that you're going to be able to make with Ancient Invention.
Must have.
There's also, of course, going to be the archaeology outfit at level 70 and the lead outfit at 99. There's going to be benefits thrown into it like they did with mining in terms of maybe getting higher XP from screening soil as you progress through the skill, in addition to being more successful, because they found players really like that with the mining rework.
Nice.
Then they went through some other items that you could potentially get, including something called a Tetra Compass, which is a 4-piece item similar to a Triskelion Key that would give you rewards. They're not saying what those is or how to put it together. Just figure it out when it releases. There's going to be the hero. Or, go ahead.
Well, I was just, like, I was confused at first about it, but then I'm like, oh no, it's a compass. What if it, like, we have to follow directions?
What's wrong with that?
Be like, just like a little mini clue. No, people love it. It'll be terrible for me. I hate looking
at it. Oh, okay, I see. Fair enough.
People love it, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting idea, a mini clue. Nice. There's going to be a hero medic that's like Tavius Rod. It'll give a number of benefits when training archaeology. They were very tight-lipped about what they'll be. There's also going to be lots of world-first broadcasts, not only for the people who get 99 and 120, but just for other things that you're going to find. And the Chronote currency is tradable.
That's cool. So people that don't want to have to like do anything to have to power up their the monolith?
Or yeah, the monolith. Change relics. Yeah. You can just go out and buy it.
That's cool.
And you're still going to need to unlock it, but you're not going to have to grind if you don't want to.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, there's going to be opportunity for money to be made for a couple months, probably, in this skill.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. Ancient invention ranges from 85 to 110 invention or so, they said. So, okay. I mean, that's not too much given the way the invention XP curve works, I guess.
Yeah. No, so,
but that was pretty much it from the live stream. Anything else that you want to mention?
Oh, dude, this was the one that I've been waiting. Like, this is what got me excited about archaeology. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems odd to say, but we're only a few days away from it now. And they did say on the live stream that that is the intent to release on Monday, and they will let us know if anything happens with that, because everybody is working from home, so this will be a skill launch remote.
Yeah.
What could go wrong? Not much, I assume.
What could go wrong? Yeah. But, dude, for the rest, like, you understand. Now that the kids are out, like, you gotta teach them. I'm going to be lucky to see archaeology, like, at midnight Monday.
Oh.
I'm telling you, it's rough, bro. It's rough.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right. Well, before we wrap up the RuneScape section, we're going to keep talking about archaeology. And earlier in the week, I sat down with Diana, and we had a bit of a chat about the five lore journals and provided a bit of context around what we know of them right now. So if you want to, of course, just learn everything that we know about the lore going in, that's coming up right now. But if you don't want spoilers, fast forward about 40 minutes or so in terms of some of the RuneScape's biggest quests that are out there. So let's have that chat right now. So as everybody's aware, next week Archaeology is going to be launching the 28th skill in-game. And, you know, this is something we've waited a long time for it to arrive. And, you know, this is something that's going to have a lot of lore associated with it. And there's already been a series of lore journals put out. So we thought we'd do a bit of the legwork for our wonderful listeners and build up a nice summary of the lore thus far and talk a bit about it. And, of course, we have a perfect person here joining us to have this discussion. And that's Diana from ClanQuest. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Shane. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you've been on for many of our quests in the past, from the Cheesecake Quest to most recently the Once Upon a Slime Quest.
Mm-hmm.
Very fun. Very fun. So, as I mentioned, Archaeology, 28th skill. We've seen the gameplay mechanics and what everybody, at least in my camp at Clan Quest, is probably most excited about, in addition to some of the PVM folks there, is the lore that we will unearth from RuneScape's past, in particular, the God Wars. The skill will launch with five dig sites covering the various factions of the God Wars, including Zaros, Zamorak, Ceridoman, Armadil, and Bandos. And, you know, we look at the past in terms of what we've received in terms of archaeology coverage, and the community has branded this skill in many ways as the new lore skill. It'll feature lore drops throughout as a bit of a random event that you get in the skill. You'll learn a bit about the dig site that you're at, and the whole point of each dig site is actually to uncover various mysteries that are there while leveling up the skill. There's also going to be the chance to have mini quests throughout the entire leveling experience, which, you know, I am personally wondering how many of those there are going to be, but we'll just have to wait for Monday to see what happens with that. But nonetheless, we just wanted to provide people with a bit of background on all the past lore that's been provided in the dig site journals. So I think we can start off with the lowest level dig site, which is Cred-et, which is the starting dig site. It's going to be Zaros themed, of course, located near Alcarid. And I think everybody who knows the desert was expecting this one to be Zaros themed, so there's not much surprise there. And in going through the lore journal, Dr. Navinick discovers two artifacts, one of which is a Zarosian art piece, which is purple and crystal themed, and the other was an armored mask. Now, this is going to look similar to Sentistan, the old dig site from the dig site quest, but Cred-et is actually an important Zarosian stronghold. It was the gathering point of powerful objects that the Majorat found from all over the Caridian desert, and they even found something called an ancient papyrus, which you can have a look at in the journal itself, and this is an example of one of the art pieces there. And if this is the kind of art that we're going to have in the archaeology skill, it is absolutely amazing. What did you think of the art pieces that we saw in this piece here?
It was, hang on, let me just open it up. It's really interesting. It's very stylized, and it's, you know, leaving a lot up to interpretation. I think on the right there, you can see what's going to be at the core of the dig site.
Yeah.
Like there is something at the middle that we work down towards.
Yeah, with that very...
But we don't know what it is.
With that very present Zarosian symbol right on top
Yeah,
there.
And you've got like the four runes in the middle.
Yeah.
Or the blood runes and the things in the middle.
Fire, water, law.
Earth, air, and then blood at the top.
Air, right. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I almost, as everybody sees there, I almost mistook the earth symbol for something else. But anyways, there was an interesting part of this journal piece, a quote from it. My lord, I beseech thee, reach out to me and lend me your ear. What do you think that could mean?
Well, he's obviously talking to Zaros.
Yeah.
And I think just to make it really clear for everyone who's not, who may not have done the dig site quest or city, is it dig site quest? But Dr. Navinick is Azanadra. That's his human form.
Yeah, and Temple at Sentistan is of course a sequel to that.
Yeah. So Dr. Navinick here is talking to Zaros and trying to communicate with him.
And
we don't know what Zaros is.
And the sense I got when I was reading this is that he did actually communicate with Zaros, except Zaros was in his non-corporeal form. That's why the person taking down this journal was completely blown away and had no idea what was going on. At least that was my interpretation of it.
Yeah, that seems like it's what's going on.
All right. What did you take away from this journal?
Well, it's quite an interesting one. I think this site's going to be pretty good for most lorehounds because we know a lot about the Zarosian Empire anyway. It's featured really heavily in the lore so far. But it's kind of a really important location in the overall story because it's where the Majorat first joined Zaros. I don't know how familiar people are with this story, but when the Majorat first came to Gilenor, they were fighting for the deserts. So they were fighting for Ictharin.
Right.
Ictharin, I can't say his name properly. But at some point during that war, they defected to Zaros. I think Sliske is the one who precipitated it.
Yeah.
And this is where they first met him and kind of turned the tide of the war or changed the sides. So that'll be a really interesting event to learn more about. It's kind of on, for me, it's on par with the betrayal that we got to see in Children of Mar.
That was a good scene.
Yeah, so it's going to be, that's one of the reasons I'm excited for it. And then the second one is, like I said, Azanadra's going there. And he was there for that defection. So how's he going to react to all of this? What are we finding in, you know, his temple? And Azanadra was the leader of the Zarosian Church and kind of still is, but the Zarosian Church doesn't really exist anymore. So, yeah, his interactions with it as a character are going to be really interesting as well. And uncovering this second age history, this like Zarosian dead history.
And then I think
what's that going to be like?
Yeah. And then I think the question that comes from that is, you know, what are the Majorat that are left over going to think about this, including Dr. Navinick, which I'll let you explain exactly who he is.
Oh yeah, I just went over this, Shane. Dr. Navinick is Azanadra.
There we go.
So, yeah, that's his disguise. I don't know whether... The thing I can't work out through Dr. Navinick's interactions is whether people are aware that he's Azanadra or not. I don't think he.
I don't
are.
Think so. I don't think so.
I think that's just between, you know, him and the World Guardian at this stage.
Yeah, yeah.
That might be blown out into the open.
And if that were to happen, the question is, would there be any fallout from that? Because, you know, we're living in a different world post the world wakes and being World Guardian and having all this information. We are entrusted to hold all these secrets, as it were. And that's why I asked to just, you know, spill the beans on that name, because, you know, there are players out there who might not be aware of that fact, that the link is so tight between those two. But at the end of it, when you put yourself on the level of your character knows. But does the average person who is going to be walking through this dig site helping out know? The player-owned nerds, as they were called in
player-owned nerds,
in one
yeah.
of the episode Q&As? I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder. And what was it in Ritual of the Marjorat when... Okay, I'm going to really butcher his name here, and I can only apologize for this. But Wahisital, his human form was... Ali the Wise.
Yeah.
And when that was revealed, that was a shock to the other NPCs in the quest. That was, you know, something shocking and worth commenting on.
So then by that so theory, they probably don't know.
They probably don't know.
Yeah.
And it'd be interesting to see how people react.
Yeah.
But yeah, this particular one, Karadat, is one I'm particularly excited for.
Yeah, I think everyone's going to be excited about that one, just because, you know, Zaros has always been the godlike creature that everybody would flock to for, you know, following and worshiping.
Yeah, there's a lot of Zaros fans around. A lot of Zaros fans.
Yeah, I want to say I was the first back in the day, but...
You were the first. Of course you were.
Yeah. In any case, what do you think we're going to discover from this one? If you had to just go out,
I think we're going to get some more. Oh, it's really hard to tell because they say there might be mini quests and lore drops all the way through it, but we don't really know what direction they're going to take that in. Like, are we going to get kind of event lore? Are we going to get, you know, little informations about what battles took place? Or are we going to get more character-focused ones? Like, is Azanadra going to get some development? Is there going to be new characters introduced that aren't alive anymore?
Right.
Are we going to get some development on what the Empire itself was like?
I think that'd be really neat to see just how expansive it was, because we've heard how big it was, but we didn't know what it was exactly like.
Yeah, so it's kind of modeled on the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Kind of that's the real life.
That's a general feeling, I think. That's a good
analogy.
And
in terms of scale and power in as well, like it has been described as the greatest empire Gillen has ever seen. So are we going to get more information on that?
Yeah.
I hope so. I really hope so.
And folks, this is just one dig site that you can come to expect. And, you know, as you could tell, we could probably spend, you know, another 25 minutes or so just batting ideas back and forth on this one. But we will be, of course, as the skill unearths itself, doing more coverage on all the lore aspects of each of the dig sites in the following weeks that archaeology is launched. The next one up is the Infernal Source, which is just north of there at the Jolly Boar Inn basement. It's Zamorak themed. And the Infernal Source, of course, does have a connection to Mavario and Mavario's device. And this journal quite specifically asks, what exactly is it? And it goes to a point where Mavario says that he believes that time sprites are interfering with the device, and it worked before the time sprites appeared. And for the player's sense, the time sprites are the little in-game mechanic that you follow around for higher XP and a more lean-forward archaeology experience. We don't know right now what exactly time sprites are going to do from the lore perspective in the skill, or even if they're going to have one. I assume they would, since this is the lore skill. But there was a question asked in here, and, you know, this one made me chuckle because I think many RuneScape players could identify with this. They say, we don't really hire anyone normal, do we? In terms of people working at the dig site and things that are happening there, all sorts of weird things.
It's just one thing after another, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Then there was a exchange between Mavario and Rainier. I'm guessing that's how that's supposed to be said, with words mentioned including pot hunter, treasure hunting lunatic, and we will cut your funding, which, you know, those are things that you would expect to hear from a government bureaucracy in this day and age. But, you know, with Mavario involved, you have to really anticipate that something big is going to be happening at this one, and being Zamorak themed. We already have the peering into that after the Zamorak heist quest, Dishonor Among Thieves. And
Brilliant quest.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. Yeah. So good.
And I think the biggest question that we can kind of meander off into our general discussion on this one is, what is the Monolith?
So the Monolith, when I was writing up my notes for this one and doing a bit of research for this little section, I kind of forgot what the Monolith was.
Yeah, me too.
And it's only really just before we started here that I remembered that we see it at the dig site. When I say the dig site, I mean the dig site, capital letters, which becomes
proper.
The archaeology hub. Yeah. So that Monolith is the great big thing in the center that you've seen, possibly we've seen in some preview videos. And obviously, this is where it was found. And then it must get activated somehow. But I remember at the RuneFest demo for archaeology, the Monolith was standing in the middle of the archaeology hub, just kind of spinning around with lots of light coming out of it. So I believe it might be some kind of power source, but beyond that, I really don't know what it is.
All right, so that'll have to, we'll have to deal with more research on this once the skill arrives. And
yeah. I think it'll be one of the mysteries that's solved throughout the skill is, what is this thing and what can we do with it?
Yeah. Okay, so other notes on the Infernal Source. You know, Movario, we haven't seen him for a while. We primarily know him from Wel'Gothic Sleeps and Ritual of the Majora, which are two very important quests in RuneScape's history.
Mm-hmm.
And
so,
go ahead.
I was about to say, do you want me to dive into a quick summary of them?
Or? Please.
I say quick summary, this might they're not quick quests.
They're not, but we're going to try and keep it quick.
Yeah, so Wel'Gothic Sleeps came out in 2008. Just let that sink in for a second. And it was, I think it was the first Grandmaster quest.
It was. It was.
And it was basically where we started to fight Lucien as the main antagonist. He was the main antagonist of the Fifth Age, and this was his one of his big moments. And yeah, basically it's where we first find the Stone of Jas. And Movario was key to that.
One of the first Elder artifacts, which we know what happened to it in Sliske's endgame, blown to bits. And I will put a whole spoiler thing on this if people don't want lore spoiled to them.
Oh, yeah, big lore spoilers on all of this, by the way. Yep. Huge lore spoilers.
This is more for people who want to kind of have a leg up as they head into archaeology, because you are going to hear about all these things.
Yeah. So this was basically one of the quests that kicked off a lot of the storylines that have since come into the Sixth Age, kind of with the Dragonkin and the Majorat and all that jazz. terrible pun. I'm terribly sorry. That was unintentional.
All right. Ritual of the Majorat.
So Ritual of the Majorat is one of the lead-ons from Wel'Gothic Sleeps. And it was the first time we got to see all the Majorat coming together for, you know, clues in the name, for their ritual. It's another Lucien quest, and it was actually his finale quest because, spoiler alert, he dies at the end. It's another one with Dragonkin in it. Movario, I think, pops up a couple of times. It's been a long time since I've done these quests.
I think he does. So. Me too.
Yeah.
You know, one thing.
But I think the point is that we're getting a character who hasn't really had much of an influence for. So, well, Ritual of the Majorat was 2011. So he's been running around in the cavern underneath the ritual site for 10 years now.
Yeah.
And he's finally getting a bit more screen time.
And, you know, with this, just to underscore the importance of this, in my view, Ritual of the Majorat was the quest that set up the events leading to the World Wakes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of a finale to some quest lines, but you're right, it did also kick off a lot of others.
Yeah.
Particularly, it was the start of Sliske's quest line.
Yeah, it was the very, very early rumblings of the fact that, you know, we might be headed to the Sixth Age kind of thing, but we didn't know that at the time. And you picked up on something relating to I wouldn't say modern, but just going to say a real world piece of fiction that the Infernal Source is based on with this.
Yeah. So RuneScape and, you know, Jagex material often features nods to pop culture, and there's references all over the place to comedy and, you know, Monty Python style stuff. But we've got a bit more highbrow for this one. Dante's Inferno which is a piece of classical literature, is being referenced quite heavily. Basically, I think I haven't actually read it myself, but it's the title character going down through the nine circles of hell into a center. And at that center in Dante's work is Satan himself. So if we have a parallel to that here, I mean, first off, kudos for actually, you know, reading something that's not Monty Python. And there is something at the bottom. There is something very big at the bottom, and we've been told to bring Silverlight. So it's a demon, whatever it is.
Yeah, and you know, this is a piece I haven't read as well, but this is telegraphing what we're going to find in Infernal Source. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
Mm. There is a big bad at the bottom for, I think, possibly the PVMers to get stuck into.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about that a bit. And you're probably wondering, what are two lore people going to talk about PVM? But you have some ideas on this.
I'm going to dive into some wild speculation and go back to 2017 RuneFest, the first RuneFest I went to, where they revealed Hostilius, who, as a boss fight, as one of the big endgame bosses. He was the Chthonian ruler, again, I'm sorry if I butch that pronunciation, of Infernus, which is the demon homeworld. And he pops up a couple of times in kind of the lore in general. He was the one who Zaros tricked into giving 12 legions of demons to come to Gilanor and kind of conquer and start his empire. And then in the Third Age, when Zamorak first ascended, the first thing he did was go to Infernus and lead the Avernic demons in a rebellion to overthrow their rulers. And he banished Hostilius to the Abyss, which is kind of this space between worlds that we travel through and we teleport. And he's been trapped there ever since, Hostilius, I mean. So yeah, I remember the concept art for the boss fight, and I couldn't find it whenever I was, you know, doing my research for this. But yeah, that was a couple of years ago now. And I wonder, huge speculation, it probably isn't, but are we going to find Hostilius at the bottom of the Infernal Source?
We could, you know. Last year when they launched the Third Elite Dungeon, they brought it out with a quest. And that quest wasn't announced until day of.
And it was a big quest.
It was, you know, and we've been dry on PVM for a long time in terms of major boss updates. So maybe they could be kind of just throwing this one under the radar, that this might be something that is unlocked through some level of the archaeology skill. And I don't want to get anyone's hopes up here, but maybe. I mean, there's precedent of it in the past.
It would be really fun if it was.
Yeah.
And if you go down there and you get the bottom of hell, you find this enormous trapped demon that you have to fight. Uh-huh. I mean, how fun would that be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One question I had on this, is there any possibility that the Infernal Source could connect up with Floor 61 of Daemonheim or have some kind of lore hook up into
that? I wonder. It kind of depends how heavily the gods themselves feature in this skill. I mean, for people who don't know, Floor 61 is the Zamorakian headquarters. It's where Zamorak's based at the moment.
Yeah. And that's why
currently inaccessible through dungeoneering. But I think I remember this might have been at RuneFest again, that 2017 RuneFest again, where they talked about making it a kind of boss fight, where you get to the bottom of Daemonheim, you go one floor deeper, and you have to fight some kind of Zamorakian force.
There we are.
Or Zamorak himself, which I think would be, you know, a bit weird, but
I don't know. At this point. Yeah. And so for the PVMers, there's two little bones that you could potentially have coming into next week's archaeology launch. So just keep that in mind. The Infernal Source might be interesting to you.
Mm.
All right.
I'm quite excited for this one because I remember for the preview video they did, it looks amazing. I mean, all these sites look amazing.
Yeah, they do. They do.
But this one, the aesthetic they've gone for is just like, oh, yes. Yes, please.
Now, the next one is Everlight, which is Icene-themed, located off the coast of Mauritania. And those of you who know your Icene lore and have done the Myrec series will know exactly why it is located off the coast of Mauritania. The perceived goal with this one is discovering the fate of the vampire strike force who gave their lives for Lord Zamorak in the fight over there. And, you know, many people at this dig site, in the lore at least, have been asking why do the time sprites keep leading to Icene corpses, and that's something we're going to uncover there. Vanescula also does not want the Archaeology Guildmaster to have anything to do with the lighthouse that they uncover. And one thing that is very ominous, or maybe, I don't know, beautiful in a way, depending on how you look at it, is that it's described in the journal that the time sprites moved from the dig site out over to the water, and the water started shining, and the big Everlight, I guess we're calling it, what are we calling it? Like a beacon, I guess?
It's a lighthouse.
Rose up, and it is the symbol of hope for the Icene. So we're trying to figure exactly why that happened and what's going to be involved around that. And Vanescula, for some reason, wants the light from Everlight gone and taken away forever with this.
So. Yeah.
And, you know, this is the one that I am perhaps the most excited about. And I know I said that about the Zaros one, but this is one that when I was playing through that quest line, it was just like, okay, we need a little bit more lore on this, please, just a little bit more. Yeah. And we never did get it before the quest line wrapped, and this is our chance to do that.
Yeah, the Vampire quest line, the Mareki quest line, is quality from start to finish. Quite long and quite in-depth, but it was really, really good. So quite cool to be going back to Mauritania, getting some more kind of lore in that kind of area, and more Vanescula Drakan, and I love her.
Yeah.
She's stone cold and brilliant, and I love her. But this is going to be another really interesting one, because it's the Saradominist one.
Yes.
And we don't know an awful lot about Third Age Saradominism. So the previous ones, like the Zarosian one and the Zamorakian one, we already know quite a lot about them and their lore. But this is one that we're going slightly into uncharted territory, which is going to be good. It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, many people automatically just always started off with following Saradomin. When back in the day, we only knew there were three before the quests were developed: Saradomin, Gothix, and Zamorak, of course. But when you expand this out, the followers of Saradomin, the Icene, they in their own right have their own very unique lore elements to it, and that was partially uncovered in the quest line. But I imagine we'll be learning more about that and how this all split apart with the Zarosian influence around there, Zamorak, and pretty much everybody else that happened back when these folks were, I guess you could say, not almost extinct, because I don't know that there's many Icene left, are there?
There aren't many left at all. I think I can... Oh, there's less than five, I think, yeah. In-game. There's Queen... Oh, why are all these names so hard to say? Queen Erefite, I think, who you find in the last couple of quests in the Mareki series. You have her son, Safalan,
yep.
Who's half Icene, half human. There's... I think there's a couple more. There's the ginger. What's her name? Saradomin's general in the God Wars.
Commander Zilyana.
Zilyana, that's it. And there's one more who hangs around in the Falador Castle and has been there for a while now. But they're the only ones I can think of who are still around in-game.
So very limited.
There used to be a lot more of them. And I think what we're going to see is some more details about a Third Age conflict where a vampire strike force invaded Hallowvale, which is what used to be Mauritania. It used to be a Saradominus settlement of Icene.
Yes, that's
and I
right.
think we're going to see what happened when the vampires invaded. What I assume is their capital, which is where the Everlight comes in. I don't know whether you want me to go a little bit more into where the Everlight comes from.
Yeah, let's do that.
So what we know about Icene is that they come from... They're another alien race. They've come from a different world and they were brought together in all by Saradomin. But the world they came from has this year-long day-night cycle. So, you know, it turns very, very slowly. And that means the night, which lasts for a year, is deadly. You know, they freeze to death. There's no food. You can't live
right
there. So what they did, they would fly around the world, kind of keeping ahead of the night, staying in the daylight all the time. So they were constantly in light. And I think how the lore goes is that when they came to Gilinor, the idea of a 24-hour or however long a day is in RuneScape, like... It gets dark every night. That's obviously going to be quite distressing for creatures like that.
Right.
So Saradomin created this lighthouse. So they would always have light. And it's kind of the symbol of hope. And like, this is their home.
Hence the term Everlight.
Yeah, hence the term Everlight. And I think it was destroyed by the vampires when they invaded, obviously. and now it's back, which might be why Vanescula doesn't like it.
It harkens back to an age where, you know, they probably want to forget that, because the vampires would definitely see that as a victory at this point.
Yeah, kind of, we destroyed this and now it's back.
Oh no, what's happening next?
Yeah.
All right, what else do you think about Everlight?
It's gorgeous. It's so pretty. This was the demo level at RuneFest. So there was a little bit at the hub and there was a little bit at Everlight. And it is the atmosphere and the lighting of it is just, it's very somber. And I remember there's a fantastic piece of, I don't know whether it's concept art or kind of the inspiration art they use for it, that has all these very low, like the dark dankness of Mauritania and then this huge blue lighthouse coming out of the ground. And the contrast of the light, it just looks so good. And the aesthetic of it is kind of, I said that the Zarosian Empire was Roman. This is classical Greece. The Sarah-Dominist one is from classical Greece. So again, very beautiful classical architecture and aesthetic.
And
so, yeah, go on.
And just the fact that we're taking from ancient Rome and now ancient Greece, it really shows how you can, you know, take something as the bedrock of an idea in a story or a video game in this place, modify it to fit your game's world, and yet it can tell a completely different story while still feeling just a tiny, tiny bit familiar.
Yeah, it kind of helps because people kind of know what to expect.
Yeah.
If you're building on a real life trope, but you can obviously adapt that to whatever suits.
It's impeccable design in that case. And this was one that they actually put a bit more into in terms of the graphics polish and the extra time that they took when it was going to launch. They showed it on stream and everyone was just blown away at it.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to this. I think I'm going to be going around with my little camera taking loads of screenshots for this one.
I think we're going to have to do a graphics section for this skill as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Anyways, anything else?
Speaking of pretty ones.
Move on to Stormguard?
I don't think so. I think I covered all I wanted to cover for that one.
All right. Stormguard Citadel. And, you know, this is something you might have heard of before, and it's easy to imagine where we're going with this one. The entrance, and I underscore this, that the entrance is at the Temple of Ikov, but the actual dig site itself is going to be Armadil themed, and that means it's going to be up in the sky. Said to be the home of aviancy inventors, and you can imagine that this is probably where our invention tilt in this skill is going to come in, at least in the beginning. And this entire Stormguard Citadel has been marketed as the opportunity for you to discover as what happened to Armadil's laboratory to make it a pile of floating rubble in the sky. And when you think about it, floating rubble in the sky, there still must be some kind of magical force that's still there to make a pile of rubble actually float. And they're doing research there involving Ethereum that was used to create the Magnum Opus. And just for anybody wondering, Ethereum armor is actually a cosmetic override in the mining and smithing skill that you can get by completing Artisan's Guild research, or I guess, what do they call it there? Experience, or
Something like that. Have you managed to get the concept art for the Ethereum armor?
No, I don't have the concept artwork for the Ethereum armor.
Let's see if I can find it.
But I have seen it in game, and it is something I want to go for when I have.
It's another thing that's very, very pretty.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll see if I can put, the image in the Google Doc?
Please do. And you know what I wanted to do is to really just, in terms of going for this, it just seemed like something that was so different from the armor that we had that it was just something that I wanted to have at the end of the mining and smithing skill. But it was initially going to be a variant of Masterwork, but they just made it a cosmetic at the end of the day, which I think is fine. And I'm interested to see how exactly that's all going to filter into the dig site.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for an invention hub, which is where I think this is going to be.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. We were having a bit of a discussion pre-show on this. Do we talk a bit about the Temple of Ikov in terms of how that's going to play in? Because the Temple of Ikov was the quest where we get the Staff of Armadil. The entrance to this dig site is at the Temple of Ikov, but I don't know personally if this dig site is going to involve the Temple of Ikov itself. What do you think on that?
It's I mean, like you said, it's where, again, a very, very old quest, 2002, where you kind of first encounter Li Shen and you steal the Staff of Armadil for him. And that's the only real connection between the location and the Armadilian dig site. So maybe there's going to be some connection there. It might be a bit of a reach. I'm not sure. Yeah, it's going to be nice if there is a link.
Yeah, it would. It would. And, I mean, you go back in the lore of Temple of Ikov and you might be able to find that, but, you know, I did this quest back in 2004. I'm not gonna remember
very
it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know when you did this, but it was a long time ago for me.
So. Yeah, very long time ago now.
All right.
2002. It's almost 20 years old.
And it's all being tied together here in 2020.
Wow, yeah.
All right. What did you take away from this journal, or what are you expecting from this dig site?
So this dig site is another really pretty one. They've managed to get some kind of, you know, thunder and lightning aesthetic going along all the way through it. It's the second strictly Armadilian location we get. The first one was the Empyrean Citadel, which featured in a lot of the Stiske quests, and that was Armadil's kind of seat of power on Gilinor. It was where his throne was. So this is another floating fortress, kind of very similar to the Clan Citadels, which I'm not sure if people remember this, but they're also Armadilian relics. These floating islands, apparently they are just around in RuneScape, in Gilinor. They're just a thing.
Yeah, miles up, apparently.
Yeah, that the Armadilians left over, and the Avianci left from the God Wars. So, yeah, it sounds like it's going to be an invention hub. It sounds like we're going to learn a lot more about Third Age technology and what were they making in the God Wars. What kind of weapons did they have, maybe? Because this is going a bit more into speculation and things I've heard outside the game with the lore, kind of in discussion with mods.
Yeah, this journal seemed more limited than the rest in terms of what it provided.
But in terms of what I was going to say is about the technology of the God Wars, there's been some implications that it's actually far more advanced than the tech we have in game at the moment. And that when the God Wars ended, it was lost. So maybe we're going to rediscover something.
That's really interesting. Because I know they said they wanted to do something like that with invention, but, you know, they never did. It was kind of just at the periphery on that when invention first came out. And now here's the kick to, you know, really supercharge that ancient technology, except this time through the archaeology skill and with lore. And I think that makes more sense than just, you know, dropping it in with the invention
skill. So leaning more into the, you know, this is a medieval fantasy game, but are we going to start leaning a little more into fantasy rather than medieval?
That's a very good question. Which I think could be very exciting. Yeah, especially for the, you know, all the gizmos and whatnot that we're going to be able to create to put on our weapons and the like. I know the PVM folks are already getting very excited about that, and the few that have been leaked going forward, combined with the relics that we'll find, which are across all the dig sites. So, that's going to be very fun to see indeed. Should we move on to Warforge, our last one?
I think so, yep.
All right. And this one is, of course, Bandos themed, if you've been keeping track here. And this is at the old former Mobilizing Armies area, just to the west of Ooglog. Now, in the journal on this one, the time sprites lead to a trove of artifacts, including shields, helmets, and goblin mail, all, of course, decorated with ancient tribal goblin symbols. And, you know, as we see in this journal, Ventnose and Wartface are still fighting as they did back in the first goblin quest, which was a fun little chuckle. And we'll have to see if that makes its way into any of the archaeology aspects on this one. But I enjoyed seeing that. And then it got really sinister because Warforge was an ancient Bandos military institution, and it was said that goblins were sent in and warriors came out. Then there was a message that was dropped by from someone who was just called a friend. And the friend said that they know many stories of Warforge. None of them were good. This was where Bandos trained his armies. Everybody who went in fought to the death. The survivors that came out became mercenaries. And before being banished at the end of the God Wars, Bandos collapsed the entrance. And that's what we are unearthing here with this dig site. And there's also something called the Forge Wars, where it was said that only a few that went in and were stuck in there when Bando started to collapse the entrance, only a few escaped when he did that. So absolute, utter cruelty on the part of Bandos. But that fits within the character, I think.
Yeah, Bandos is another one we know next to nothing about. I mean, he had a bit of development in the Goblin Quest series, the Cave Goblin Quest line.
World Event 2 as well, but he's dead
World
now.
World Event 2, but they killed him off. And I know some mods regret killing him off because it meant they had to, you know, put a stop to his story. That was it. I mean, I wasn't actually playing the game at the time of World Event 2, so I skipped all the, you know, actual action of it. But I don't think it was a bad idea.
Okay.
Kind of in terms of the development it led for Armadyl. I thought that was very interesting. But the disadvantage is that we now know next to nothing about him. I mean, the only real source of proper Bandos lore I could find were the Bandos memories that you unlock after the Mighty Four.
Yeah.
And they work in a similar way to the Zarosian and Saren memories that you can collect around Preftinus and on Frenesco. So they give little snippets of history of how did he become a god and all that jazz. What was his backstory? But other than that, we know nothing.
And so, I guess that's what we're going to learn in this dig site, rather than the fact that we know much more about, say, a Zamorak or a Zaros, and their dig sites will more be fleshing things out. This will be providing primary source, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. And I think it's going to be interesting. Just reading through, hearing you read through the journal again, I suspect the friend, in inverted commas, is Zanuck.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. That's what I thought too.
I think you'll need someone who's used to the dark. I think that's Zanuck, looking at it again.
Yeah.
Which is great, 'cause she's another character I love a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
But yeah, it'll be nice to get anything really on Bandos. Even though, you know, he's obviously a despicable character. But just to have some kind of information about him and how he was in the Third Age.
Because we know nothing at this point. This is all we got.
Very little, very, very little.
For our lore summary on Warforge, literally what we got in the journal here, like you said, the Bandos memories and the Goblin Quest. That's all we have on Bandos,
pretty much. Yeah,
which is kind of unfortunate, but you know, we're only a few days away at this point from being able to rectify that, depending on the leveling curve required to get to Warforge. And you know,
do we know what level you need to get into it?
No, we don't. I don't know offhand, at least.
I can't remember off the top of my head, but they mentioned in one of the preview videos.
And, you know, the important part, I think, about this, and this is something that people need to remember with the archaeology skill, is that you unlock a crit at the first dig site. But I think it was mentioned in the live stream that there's content going all the way up to level 117 at that first dig site for people. So it's not something that you're just going to, you know, spend, you know, a day or two at and then move on.
Yeah, from how I understand it, you start at one dig site, level up, and then as you can unlock another one, go and do the other dig site, and then come back to the first one and find out more, and there'll be fresh new stuff for you to do, like you said, all the way up into up to close to 120.
Warforge is level 76.
76, yeah.
Yeah, so.
So you can hop between them as your skills increase. You can find new things in the same locations as your skill increases.
Yeah. Stormguard Citadel is level 70, Everlight 42, Infernal Source 20, and Crit at level 5. And, of course, you get the first 5 levels from the tutorial, I'm betting.
Yeah, that'll be from the hub.
All right. That pretty much covers what we wanted to talk about for the pre-lore roundup for archaeology in terms of what these journals provided and provide a bit of additional context surrounding them. Is there anything you'd like to throw in on any of these journals before we head off? Anything we missed? Anything that you want to provide to the listeners before we go?
I don't think so. I think I covered all I wanted to cover.
All right. And I guess before we let you go, I'll just ask you, and you know, I think it was probably alluded to here, but if you had to pick one of these dig sites, which one are you most looking forward to?
Oh no, don't ask me that. It's so hard to pick, I mean, from a lore perspective, the Zyrosian one, obviously, because I find that really interesting, personally. I'm a huge Zamorak fan, so the Infernal Source is going to be interesting as well. Everlight is gorgeous. Stormguard Citadel is going to be great for, you know, finding out more about Armadyl, getting that invention in there. And then Warforge is, you know, finding out fresh stuff, so they're all going to be really good. I think in terms of the ones I'm most excited for, it's tie between Caradet and Stormguard.
All right.
But Everlight comes in close as well. It's so hard to pick one.
All right. For me, it's Everlight.
Yeah.
But all right.
Were you impressed last year for the Everlight demo?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't.
Oh, you missed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. It looked really good.
Only a few days left, so we'll be fine with that.
Monday. So, 5 days.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Shane.
All right. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that. I know I had fun recording it and refreshing on some of those quests going way, way back to 2002. In that case, some of them there. Granted, I wasn't there back then, but I did these quests way back when in 2005. And, you know, Temple of Ikov, we're talking about that being touched on in this. Big ones like Ritual of Majorat, Wellgothic Sleeps, and The World Wakes, all of those things are going to have a role in terms of how this all shakes out. So that's why we had that discussion there. But, you know, I think there's one thing we want to talk about before we move on to our listener discussion topic or question from the week, is that we have this new dev blog out now about highlighting and canopy cutout with Mod Sage from the Core Experience team. And, you know, there was actually an interesting little bug last week, is that they actually shipped object highlighting before it was ready. And
oops.
The fact we're talking about this now suggests that, you know, we're going to see this sooner rather than later. And you have two before and after screenshots here with this. And I recommend everybody go have a look at the dev blog. But the way it works is that anything that's an object that is interactable will be highlighted with a very light blue color. And, you know, that's perfect for questing, because with the dynamic environments that we have now, and I'm talking about you, Anachronia, is that it's really hard to know what exactly is interactable and what is not. So I think based on this first one that we see here, the object highlighting looks really good. It's going to be a feature that we can all benefit from. How do your eyes and screen do with cyan, Tanis? That bright blue?
It doesn't.
Oh.
It doesn't. Yeah, I don't really see.
I guess you'll have to wait for colorblind mode whenever they ship that then.
Yeah. Hopeful.
Yeah. Okay.
And, I mean, the other part of this, like, it wasn't super, like, I love the idea, but I wish it had been a little bigger, because it wasn't big enough for me.
Right. Right. Okay. So just maybe a bit more. And, you know, I think looking at what we saw in the live stream a few weeks back when they showed this, you remember we said, it's like, oh, I can't even see that. And I'm betting that was the live stream compression butchering it away, because these screenshots are actually pretty actionable based on what we have. So they're fine for me. I don't know. Maybe they could just add a bit more of a high contrast option, I guess. Would you say that's the issue with it? Or how would you describe the issue?
I'd just like a little bit more of it.
Okay.
Because, like, I kind of have to look around something to be able to see it. You know what I mean? Like, can't look directly at something and see it. Like, I have to kind of look around. And so, if I would have had a little bit more of a, yeah, I mean, I guess contrast would help too, but yeah, no, I mean, love the idea, because, you know, you can't see yourself half the time you're thieving and Prith and stuff like that.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And that takes us into, the next one, and that's the character silhouettes, which is something that, we didn't see on the last one, is that if you're behind a wall and your character's half obscured, you'll still be able to see the outline of your character through that wall. which is something cool. We weren't aware of before. Yeah. And, I mean, I've shown RuneScape to people before, and they're like, oh, where's my character? And then they realize they got to, you know, use the arrow key to move the mouse or move the camera around to see it. And that's just kind of annoying. And this is what this is smoothing out.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the tree canopy cutout, because this one is shown in the Lost Grove and McCrupper's Wood, which is your favorite location.
I'll take care of that for you. Do all the cutouts you want.
You know, I like the silhouettes. I like the object outlining. But I think the tree canopy removal, it's just too narrow. Too narrow yeah. of a frame, I feel, and for what you're seeing here. And
we need more of it, too.
Yeah, it needs to be a bigger field.
I like
field.
All these things. I just want more of them.
Yeah, and to be clear for anyone listening for the first time, Tanis does use a screen reader to play and is legally blind. So his experience is totally different than the rest of ours when it comes to playing this.
Yes.
So, and you know, another annoying thing I see with the canopy cutout is it's using that same filtering technique that they use for the camera, where they want to effectively kind of make it kind of fade away, but you can still see it in a particle-y sense, if that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense. Does it?
I mean, I know what you're saying.
Like the particles. It looks like rather than just being a nice cloud fade through, you can actually see the individual particles. I don't know if that's an engine limitation or if it's something that hasn't been fixed, but that's kind of annoying.
Yeah, hopefully that'll get cleared up. I just feel like it makes it less clear.
Yeah. So I think based on what we've seen here, the object outlining is good. You'd just like it to be a little bit more impactful. The character silhouette is good as it is. And the tree canopy cutout needs to be a little bit bigger as well. And I'll even agree with that one on this. And, you know, it was really noticeable on the live stream. And even I didn't know if that was compression or what, but based on this screenshot that they have posted here, it also appears to be a similar kind of issue with the artifacting that's going on around it. So just make it a bit bigger and maybe see if that artifacting can go away, I think. Then, Then we get to the fun part here about how outlining is done.
Okay.
Do we have time to go through this?
Hold on, boys and girls. Strap in.
This is the tech talk that people like Sirion and myself like. So for outlining, first they draw the game without any highlights. And then doing this also fills in what's called the depth buffer with information about how far away each pixel is from the camera, which when you think about it makes sense for a 3D game. Each object we want to highlight is then drawn twice, once at a larger size with the highlights color, and once at a smaller size with a pitch black color. Then in both cases, it uses the depth buffer generated earlier to avoid drawing the highlight through walls or other objects. A blur effect is then applied on the highlights to soften their edges and eliminate any visual glitches that might pop up. And then the blurred highlights are then added onto the screen, and then you're left with the cyany blue texture. And they say silhouettes are handled in a similar way, where instead of drawing at different sizes and checking the depth buffer both times, we use the size for both and only check against the depth buffer on the last draw operation. And that's it for the technical side on that one. And then, oh boy, the trees one here seems very complicated. So for the trees, in terms of making your character visible through them, first, they need to figure out if your character is visible. This is done by using something called hardware queries. And we're venturing into the territory of what the GPU does here now. Because they say this basically let you ask the GPU about how long it took to draw something, or if it's visible at all, or how many pixels are occupied. And a downside of using them is that for performance reasons, we can't get the results back from a query in the same frame it was used, because doing this would force the CPU to wait for the GPU to finish drawing the frame. So unpacking that is that they can't know on the same frame that is rendered what exactly is happening with this. So to avoid this, they don't extract the results until they're ready, so the entire system takes it into account for a 1 or 2 frame delay. All right, that makes sense, and I guess that's allowable when it comes to the trees. And they say they begin by drawing the character player with the last query type mentioned above, comparing the pixel count obtained from it against how many pixels it would occupy if there is nothing in the way. And then based on this, it gives a visibility percentage. So what that means is how visible is your character just based on what the GPU says. And I think that's a fairly simple concept, just to distill it down to a visibility percentage, how much of your character is shown and not obscured by other objects on screen, right?
Sure.
Okay. And then they convert this value into a transparency amount that involves averaging it with the values obtained in the previous frames and animations. And they do this so they can avoid transparency oscillating rapidly whenever there are small camera movements. Once this averaging process is finished, they use the current average as an input when drawing canopies and foliage, making them more transparent the smaller this value is. All right. So scene depth, and then there's pictures here that you'll definitely want to have a look at in this post, because you really can't see what I'm describing here over audio. So if this is interesting to you, have a look at all the pictures that have been posted here in the dev blog. And then they say there's one last important detail. Since the values used are calculated based on what was drawn in the previous frame, to modify what's drawn in the current one, whenever we prepare a query, we make sure to take into account canopies and foliage as if their transparency was unchanged by this feature. And if this was not done, we would never obtain stable results, and the final transparency values would keep alternating. I think that's good. I find this interesting. Do you? Granted, we're in different audiences for this.
This is I really
over the head.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And, you know, I think we could take that as that, you know, if you don't want to know how works, you can stop after the tech talk thing. But if you are interested, it makes sense. You just gotta read through it a couple of times if you're not familiar on how 3D graphics rendering works. So
there we have it. The game, Shane.
Yeah. I mean, you don't think about how your trees are rendered as you're walking through them, right?
No, not really.
Yeah, I've actually in the past, you know, thought in various games, you know, how are we doing this shadow rendering? Might it be, you know, a simple way of re-rendering the character a second time and then projecting it in a skewed manner? Or are they doing something else entirely? And, you know, it's something I do think of from time to time. Granted, I don't have much experience in that, but it's a fun little exercise for me.
Okay, then.
All right. We can move on to our discussion question now, I think. That is enough of 3D graphics modeling for this.
Almost.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Patreon first, though, because that is very important. All right. So starting off, and, you know, we have a big thing that we just want to say we had a lot of fun with on this week. But first, before we do that, I'll just thank our Patreon supporters for this episode, who are 29 Let's Go, Brock H, Cameron, Cass, C, GB900, Christian S, Diana, Jade Gizmo, James W, Jason S, Joe M, John P, Kyle, Our Memories, Rastafa, Ripeth, Sam W, The Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V, and Zez. Thank you, all of you, for your support. It truly does mean the world to us. And what did we do earlier this week, Tanis, that was so fun?
Movie night.
Did I choose a good one?
You did. You did. I enjoyed the flick, man. It was. Oh man, it was so funny to see where we were in the 90s and the early 90s.
Yes, yeah, so that was 91.
What was going on? Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I chose it, because it's got that parallel with it. It was Star Trek VI, and we had some special guests with us from the RSBNB community. Earth was there. I think Rastafel also joined, and there might have been one of the other Patreon folks. But for those Patreon people who want to follow along with this, this will be going up with this week's show. We'll include our commentary with it, which – we'll tell you when to press play, and you can just listen to our commentary and listen to the, or rather watch the movie at the same time. And I think that's a good way of doing it if you missed, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably it'd be just like being there with it.
Yeah, I mean, you could even, you know, sit down and watch it on your TV and just plug the commentary in one ear on your headphones, and that would be good. So if you want to learn more about this, just visit patreon.com/RSBNB. The recording of that will be available to all patrons for as little as $1 a month. And in addition to that, you get a mention in our show notes each and every week, early access to those notes, and you, of course, are helping us fund the cost of hosting and production of RSBNB Update. For $3 a month, or our VIP rank, as we call it, you'll get a special rank on Discord and access to high-quality stereo AAC versions of the show. And our insider tier for $5 a month, you get a special shout-out each and every week on the podcast and get exclusive access to the outtakes that we use to build the clip show at the end of the year. And we haven't had too many clips in the last few weeks, but we'll see where that goes. And there are definitely going to be a lot in there by the time the year wraps up. And in addition to that, you can expect an inside RSBNB update this month on how we prepare on the website side for a new skill, because that's something not many people see, and it is a huge deal, preparing for a new skill in terms of the things that have to be updated. So look for that at the tail end of next week. The monthly bit is still up in the air. We're batting a couple of things around. I think based on the way archaeology is going, we'll probably release this one on the 10th of April, just because we are all going to be so busy next week with archaeology, if that makes sense. And the biggest thing we have to talk about is our round table. And this month's round table, we want to be archaeology themed, of course, and we'll be having that this Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern, which I believe, if I still got my times right, is 8 p.m. game time, I want to say, something to that effect, if I know exactly what's going on. But all the information for this will be posted on our Patreon page at patreon.com/RSBNB by the time you guys are hearing this. So we'll see you guys in Discord for another round table. The last time we sit together and get ready for archaeology is that comes out. So that should be good fun. And of course, we'll also have another movie in April, which Tanis is in charge of choosing this one. Any hints that you want to drop on what that'll be?
So I think I need to bring balance to the Force, and it's definitely going to be a Star Wars movie.
Okay.
I can tell you that much.
All right. Yeah. Please be a prequel?
We'll see, Shane.
All right. So if this all sounds interesting to you, just head over to patreon.com/RSBNB and sign up, and thank you for your support, everyone. It truly means the world to us. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
All right. Discussion question this week from Sunset Fish. With archaeology just a football kick away, let's talk about all the other skills. If you could completely revamp a skill, how would you change it?
Okay.
I think we got to get the elephant out of the room here.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I think I know what we would both
construction pick. Rework.
Of course, I mean, of course.
And you know, you can add other stuff to construction. And I think what everybody is, you know, most wanting in a construction rework is the player-owned house to be reworked.
Yes, and let's do it. You know, like let's do it in the style of the aquarium. you know how we how that was a little
how there's
different,
like the little grid move, that you can move yeah, stuff around with, right?
That would be cool. I mean, that, at least that's a start.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I know a prototype exists of that somewhere. I forget whether it was on the RS3 side or the old school side, but a prototype definitely exists.
Yeah, I mean that to me is like at least that would be a starting point, and you know, I don't really know where to go from there. I definitely have lots of ideas for new rooms and new stuff. I mean, old school actually even has some of the things that yeah, I have suggested in the past.
You know, I think you could get away with reworking the house just to effectively improve the UI side of it, so to speak, kind of like they did with the bank. If you can improve the UI side of it and you can give people a reason to congregate at the house as a social setting, I think you will have done it.
Yeah, that, I mean,
because house parties used to be a big thing.
Yeah, I mean, and even, I mean, and prayer altars, I guess, are still kind of.
Yeah.
But they were a much bigger thing, you know, pre-prayer, I guess.
You could have a sand pit for archaeology.
Yeah, I was thinking something like that.
Greenhouse instead of the aquarium that we got. I know Earth is still salty about that, so am I.
I've always been a big proponent of a bathroom.
A bathroom?
Yeah.
Interesting.
In a bathroom, man. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. The bathroom is missing, or the loo, as they call it in the UK.
Yeah, but see, you could have a tub that could have like different water, like you have at the springs.
Right.
You know?
Or maybe you could even have your own special blend.
You could have your own special blend. I always thought you could have like a jewelry box where you could put your jewelry in and just, I don't know. I think there was a lot of possibilities there. A lot of fun stuff.
And you know, a fun little side effect on this, we were actually back in the day going to build a house designer where, and we only built the top end of it, and that's what you see on the website right now. But the house designer we have, you were also going to be able to click on one of the individual rooms that you had there. And in addition to that, you would be able to configure how exactly that room was laid out. And this goes to kind of the overview that we've seen before, being able to place furniture and whatnot, just like you do in the aquarium. So I think if they did that, they worked on the social factor in some way. I don't even know how you would do that in this day and age. How would you make player-owned houses sociable?
I'm not a miracle worker, Shane.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I know.
You'd have to give, I mean, there has to be a reason to go. Part of the reason before was like because high levels had stuff that other people didn't have access to, so you'd have to go to their house.
Yeah. And, you know, POHs were a way to show off. And I don't know how you do that in modern RuneScape with POHs just because some people have so much money.
Well, I mean, I guess you could like, I mean, if you're an advocate for taking people's cultural heritage away from and out of their countries, you could have little exhibits in your home.
Oh, that'd be fun. And that could tie into archaeology, maybe. Or,
right.
If they're God-themed.
I'm saying it's probably the moral thing to do, but you could do that.
Yeah. Okay. And see, this is where I want to kick it back to the community, is how do you make player-owned houses sociable again? Because I think if you do that and solve the UI problem, that's all you need to do for the POH rework. And that in its own sounds – it's like a two-sentence brief for a project that would take months and months to do just based on how many items there are in there. So I'm going to answer this question with a little bit more realism to it in terms of something that is actually achievable and would probably get the go-ahead at some point in the future because the resources aren't as sparse for it. That's to make items for the magic and range skills that are like the melee skill with smithing, you know? Like throw in crafting and rune crafting and have it so we can make our own high level, you know, tier 90, 85-ish equipment for magic and ranged in the crafting skill. Maybe with a dash of rune crafting thrown in. And fletching for the range side. Because, you know, sure, you can make your own ammo with the fletching skill, and you can make your own runes with the rune crafting skill, but where are we on that armor front? It doesn't exist. So.
Yeah. I mean, the only other possibility is if you were saving that for like a enchanting skill or something. But
could you see ranged armor being in an enchanting skill, or is that primarily magic based?
No, yeah, I was thinking magic based.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the answer that I think is more actionable, and we're probably likely to see from how high that scored on last year's survey.
We'll see. I mean, they know it's what we want.
Yeah.
And we know it's what they don't want to touch.
And we know that there's players in the game, or in Jagex, in particular with the people who are working on archaeology, who are hardcore RS players. So if the game needs something, there's a very high chance that we will get it at some point. And then if I could just say one other thing on this that I'd like to see in terms of a skill rework, please let's just have something woodcutting related equivalent to deep sea fishing.
Yeah.
Because
woodcutting something.
Because, I mean, you can go cut elders like I do. You can go to your island for bamboo or do crystal trees. And I mean, that's really not a lot of choice. Mining has much more choice in it in terms of how you play, because you can lean forward, or you can chase the rock opportunities, or you can just AFK. Woodcutting doesn't have that. And the stuff that you get from woodcutting aside from the elders really isn't that useful. So I'd like to see stuff from the woodcutting skill, items from the woodcutting skill made useful in some way or another.
Yeah, I mean, do you have any idea how many lumberjacks have been out of work? I mean,
yeah,
long time now.
Yeah, you know? And I mean, we see it with fishing, that it's good with the deep sea fishing and the way that works. We saw what mining had into it, and I don't think you'd need to do a wholesale rework like they did with mining for woodcutting. You just need to add some usefulness to the wood and maybe provide some lean forward and more varied training methods. And I think that would solve that problem. So I think those are the three.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
All right, let's move on to tech news then. If you guys want to send your own questions in, email them to questions@rsbnb.com, or you can leave us a DM on Twitter @rsbnb. All right, so there's actually reason to use Safari if you're on a Mac, and be happy if you're on iOS. This week, with iPadOS and iOS 13.4 and the newest version of Safari on macOS, those browsers, the Safari web browser, has full third-party cookie blocking. So what this means is that in essence, cookies are little files that are stored in your web browser that they use to store state, like, for instance, a login to a website. But you also have people out there like Facebook who can set something called a third-party cookie. And that third-party cookie can be used to track what websites you go to and what links you click on. Then when you go back to Facebook, it reports to them. And it's basically a way of tracking users for Facebook without you being on Facebook.com proper. And for the longest time, Safari has turned third-party cookies off. You can turn them off in Chrome and Firefox as well. But now with intelligent tracking protection, there is full third-party cookie blocking. And the benefits of this means that, you know, if you really want to, you can be absolutely private and you can just say no to Facebook.
Just and other people, no to Facebook?
And other people who use third-party cookies for their ads.
we can tell Facebook to go fly a kite.
Yep. When it comes to the when it comes to these cookies, absolutely. The only other browsers that do this are the Tor browser and Brave. So this is something that Firefox and Chrome are way, way behind on this. And, you know, people always say if you're on a Mac, you can use Safari. But I don't know. Safari's always been an issue for me. Chrome is like a well-worn shoe that you just automatically go for Chrome on this one. So, but if you're on a Mac or if you're on iOS, this is a great day for Safari users on macOS and iOS with this because, you know, in addition to this full blocking with this, it also disables something prevents something called cross-site forgery attacks, which work through third-party websites that, you know, based on the name of that, allow you to have a login forged without even being on that website. And it also makes fingerprinting harder, which is a way of saying what exactly is the state of this browser and let's just take a digital fingerprint of it. And the implications of this for privacy are huge. And, you know, people always talk about Firefox and Chrome being secure and private browsers, but in this case, Brave is leading the front, as is Apple Safari and WebKit on this. So this is actually a really, really big deal for these. So I just wanted to bring this out to the forefront and tell people that if you're on a Mac, you probably might want to use Safari for a bit. And if you're on iOS, keep using Safari and don't look for something else on this. And this is going to be something that Chrome will be adopting, but they won't be shipping it until 2022.
Oh, well, I'm glad they're Johnny on the spot with that.
Yeah, isn't that right?
Jeez. Well, who needed that anyway?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So good news on the browser front this week. Next up, you know, we always talk about Stadia and Google Stream.
Do we, though? Do we really talk about Stadia?
Yeah, we
Stadia
do.
Stadia didn't.
Because we wanted it to take off, but it's like, it kind of,
I want one of them to take off. I mean, it had the potential. If they hadn't made people have to buy the game on top of it, I think it would have done.
Yeah, Stadia is one of the game streaming services out there so that you can effectively play 1080p or 4K games without needing a beast of a computer. And none of these have really taken off yet.
No, and this would have been a great time for it, but instead of having the game on there, making you have to buy it, I just think it's a problem because you have to, I mean, you're getting charged twice. No one wants to do that.
Yeah.
When you can, not when you can get Microsoft's Game Pass or PlayStation's, their service that they have.
Yeah. For the Xbox or PS4.
Yeah. But both of them can be played on PC too. So
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know.
This is a new program called Stadia Makers. They're partnering with Unity, which is one of the big game engines out there that anyone can adopt who's wanting to make a video game. And the idea behind this is that as part of the Google for Game Developers Summit, they are making it so that people who use Unity are going to be able to bring their games to Stadia easily.
I mean, I guess this could be a place for indie games.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking on this. And, you know, we'll have to see if they decide to go this route or if they just, you know, continue going down the Steam path on this one of publishing there.
They can't go down the Steam
path. Like, no, I mean general game devs.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Game devs.
Like, dude, that ship sailed.
No. And with this, they want to effectively just make it easier for developers to bring this forward, so much so that they're offering technical assistance, free development hardware, and there will be a funding option as well for some of these costs. and they're looking for Unity developers who are building their game engine on Unity 2019 and expect to ship in 2020 and 2021.
I wonder if they're locking any of these guys into exclusive deal.
I don't think so, because it says Stadia SKU, increase your game's reach by adding Stadia to your list of launch day platforms.
Well, then that might be a win-win, because they need some cheaper games, and usually, an indie game isn't normally $60 a pop, so it's kind of a win-win.
Yeah. So we'll have to see where this goes, but if they can't get traction with this, I think we'll need to re-examine the whole game streaming methodology.
Well, I still think it's a crucial part going forward. It's just that at this point, I don't think you can compete with Sony or Microsoft.
Yeah.
If anyone could have done it, it would have been Google, but they didn't. You got to invest the money in the catalog.
And just like we talked about last week, the Series X and the PS5, amazing consoles. Yeah. And with their streaming games and subscription options, it's like.
Did you see, Shane? Did you see what they're working on?
No.
You see what Microsoft? Oh, what? You missed it? Oh, my God, dude. Microsoft has a next gen VR headset.
Coming out. Okay, there we go.
It's made for that system, dude. I knew it. I'm ooh. Yeah, dude, it's gonna be good. I've heard good things this week about it.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. All right. And our last piece of tech news is timely, and it's probably something many people have heard of before, but if you haven't, it's Folding at Home. And Folding at Home has brought up a new page where they're asking for people to donate your computing power in order to help fold proteins for the COVID-19 virus. And if that sounds like something that I just spoke complete Greek to you, let me explain this in parts. So Folding at Home is a distributed supercomputer. So anybody who has a computer that has a GPU and a good CPU in it can install Folding at Home and donate your compute power to this project. Simple. You don't need to pay anything. You just run this program and your computer power is donated for the processing of what Folding at Home is doing. Now, this is where it gets really, really sticky, because I'm not an expert in protein biology in this regard, but from what I understand of what they're trying to do, is they're trying to effectively fold the COVID-19 virus in a way so that they can find new receptors on the virus, because looking at a virus on its own under a standard microscope is hard, because viruses are protein based. So anytime you touch them with something, they completely distort their shape. So it's hard to kind of figure out where a good receptor might be. Now, with this, Folding at Home allows the simulations to be done on the virus. And with this, they can learn potentially new ways that they might be able to combat this virus in terms of either finding therapeutics with it that render it inert, or finding weaknesses to the virus in terms of vaccine development, which is something that everybody has been talking about in the last few weeks or so since this virus has blown onto the scene here of the Western world, even though it was, if you go back to January, it was causing problems in China. One wonders why we didn't act sooner, but that's a topic for a different day and a different podcast.
Different podcast.
And with this, Folding at Home has also done a lot of work in the past. They actually published a scientific paper where they simulated a protein from the Ebola virus that was previously considered undruggable, and because of this, they were able to make some progress on potentially finding ways to combat Ebola. So, everybody's looking for something that they can do in combating this virus. And if you have, a computer and you're not using it for a time period during the day, you can install Folding at Home and generate your compute power. And this is something that is truly amazing in terms of the community work that has gone into it, because, you know, if you look at what exactly is happening with this, you see that, you know, you and I might only have one GPU and one CPU, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to get the exact number here. According to Folding at Home, the entire Folding at Home community crossed the exaflop boundary. And just to give everybody an idea of how that is the number one with, oh my God, this is a lot of zeros. And, you know, this is really underscoring the power of this computer here. One with, you ready for this? 18 zeros behind it.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So you can turn this on and off then?
You can turn it on and off.
You're donating it when you want? Okay.
Yeah.
And it's, you, like, it's pretty.
That's an exaflop.
Safe and all that, you know?
Oh,
you
yeah, don't have to completely worry safe. It's not malware. It's nothing. It's 100% open source, and they have guides on how to do it. And with this, it makes them 10 times faster than the IBM Summit supercomputer. So it's the largest supercomputer in the world.
And it's working on
the virus.
Coronavirus right now.
Yeah.
Gamers, come on, guys. Let's save the world. Hell yeah.
Other things it's worked on include cancers, ALS, Parkinson's, Huntington's, and the flu.
That's cool.
Yeah.
This is cool.
And they have all of their information highlighted on the website here with this in terms of how it works, the software development behind it. So if this is interesting to you and you want to donate your computer power to it, you can find it at foldingathome.org.
I would almost just leave my computer on that.
Yeah. And, you know, if it comes down to power, because, you know, most of our computers in this day and age have, you know, 650, 700 watt power supplies in them if they're gaming computers, it will use your CPU and GPU. So just be aware of that, that it'll act as if you're actually on your computer using it to, I wouldn't say its maximum potential, but medium to high potential. So. All right. Let's move on to our achievements of the week, shall we? Actually, no, I want to announce something first before that. I can announce that starting with the launch of Archaeology on Monday, we'll be doing a full month Skill of the Month, Classic Skill of the Month competition for the skill because, you know, it's a race from the ground up. And let's just see what everybody can do in 1 month because I think we're all going to be focusing in on it. So if you want to sign up for that, head on over to rsvmb.com/skotm. You should be able to sign up on it prior to the launch on Monday. It might say a different skill. It might say invention because that's the most recent skill that's been added. But I guarantee you that once it starts, it definitely will be archaeology. So with that being said, everybody, if you want to sign up for the archaeology skill of the month, skill of the month is back. Sign up at rsbmb.com/skotm. All right. Let's go on some achievements then.
Awesome. Okay, so starting out, we have a very busy black Mexican with a 99 woodcutty on March 25th, and 99 hunter on March 25th, and 99 fishing on March 25th. Then we have Stinky Pete 22 with 99 defense on March 25th. In Mythica, UK, with 99 mining on March 20.
Nice. Next up, we have Questcaping with 99 runecrafting on the 22nd. We have R3PO with 120 strength and 120 attack on the 21st. Also, Stinky Pete again with 99 ranged on the 21st. And Grayscale with 99 runecrafting on the 20th, and then one rib with 99 constitution and 99 range on March 19th. Congratulations, everyone.
Nice job.
Nicely done. Nicely done. All right. What do we got for pick of the week?
I got a pick for you, Shane.
Okay.
Are you a fan of the Doom franchise?
I'm not, actually. I never really latched on to that game.
Okay, maybe it's a little more my generation. Like, because...
Like, I remember playing the first Doom on DOS and Windows 95 and whatnot. Okay. It's just a little too graphic for me. Can you turn that down?
Oh, I don't know. Probably not. Because okay. If you think that one's graphic, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it was okay when it was 2D sprites, but today...
No, it's pretty, okay. It's pretty graphic. You know, I mean, this is not for the faint at heart or children, but it's, I don't know. It's a game that I have played for so long, a franchise I played for so long. When they rebooted it in 2016, I'm like, this is great. This is really good.
Yeah. I think we did it as pick of the week then.
Yeah, I think so, because I'm pretty sure I wrote about it. And now they've came out with Doom Eternal, and it's even better. It's like quintessential Doom. It's just like, it's Doom in all of its doomness. Like,
with modern graphics.
With modern graphics, like, it is, like, it's so fast, dude. Like, you're so fast. And it's not one of those shooters where you have to, like, look at a little pixel, like, supposed to represent 2 miles away or some crap, you know, like, no, this is fast, you're in its face, like, boom, shotgun, rip its arm off, tear its head off, rip out your chainsaw, like...
Oh, the chainsaw is still a thing.
Oh, hell yeah, dude. Okay. Yeah, and the shotguns, I mean, it's got the best, you know, shotguns, the BFG, I mean, it's so good. And the music, oh man, the music, like, it's so inspired from the original, but with this new twist to it, like, I'm a huge fan of it. And I'll tell you what, dude, this is really weird. Probably shouldn't even tell you.
Okay.
It's kind of embarrassing, but I've never done this before. So Friday night, I bought it. I didn't play it till Saturday because I didn't have time. I played it Saturday. And I had about 74 minutes on it. 65 of those minutes were like the most frustrating experience I've ever had.
More so than the tree quest?
Yeah, because, okay, so it locks you into when you start it, the default setting is full screen.
Oh.
That's fine, but... it wouldn't let you get to your settings without making a Bethesda account. So I literally struggled for an hour trying to be able to make a Bethesda account just to get to the settings so that I can use my accessibility tools. But here's the fun part. The screen and like that menu, that AI, was all buggy as shit. So as soon as you would type something in and hit enter, it bounced to another region.
That sounds like Bethesda to me.
And it sucked. So bad. Like, I was so mad. I only played the game, like, for 10 minutes, and then I'm like, I want a refund. So I literally was like, nah, screw this game. I'm getting my money back. I got my money back, and I kept seeing video after video after video come up about Doom Eternal. Doom Eternal is the best Doom. And I'm like, that wasn't my experience. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe I was too mad because of... Bethesda pissed me off. Maybe I should try it again. And I did. And I absolutely am so glad that I did. Because I love it now. It really is. Like, it really is a good, good game. But, yeah. That making that account in the beginning, ugh, dude. I'd never been so mad. I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah, that's kind of what I've heard from Bethesda stuff in the past. That's kind of rough around the edges, but once you get in, it can be so, so immersive.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. I mean, the graph, it's a really, really good game. It's a really good game. But it's one that you don't have to, like, you know, there's a story there. You can participate in it. You don't have to.
Or you know it can just be a hack and slash shooting kind of game.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't have to, like, play big, long, grindy sessions. You can play a little bit, you know, here and there. And I've enjoyed it a lot. It's been pretty good.
All right. Doom Eternal. Worth the price of a headlining game, I guess, is the next question.
Yes. In fact, I did it twice.
Oh, okay. Fair enough, though.
No, I mean, it is worth it, but if you want a little bit of an extra value, Shane, the Epic Store has World War Z for free right now.
Oh.
Along with a bunch of other games. Okay. I know you don't love I know you don't love that launcher, yeah. But that's like a $50 game, $40-$50 game, and for free.
Yeah.
Sign me up, man.
All right. Well, Doom Eternal, system requirements for anyone wondering, recommended a i7-6700K or better, 8 gigs of RAM, GTX 1060. So not too bad. Not too bad.
Not too bad, and I'm telling you, it's worth it, because the glory kills are so... Oh, man. It's my kind. This is my kind of, like, shooter. Like, because you're fast, you know, so you just run, like... And I can literally run up on someone, hit them with a shotgun, and then hit them with a chainsaw. You know, like, it's like in your face, you know, and that's like the best kind of shooter.
The last one
me.
I played was Doom 3, which I think was Windows 98.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Long time ago.
Yeah. Then that one was definitely a story, much more a narrative. Yeah.
I remember the old ones, too, and I think... that was like a classic first person shooter.
Hell on Earth. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Doom Eternal available on Steam. Let's talk about what we've been up to on RS, and I'll go first because, you know, I don't really have anything to say except Yak Track, honestly.
Yeah.
It is the best. It is the thing I look forward to on RS, you know? Aside from quests and, you know, skilling updates and whatnot, Yak Tracks. I'm so glad we're going to be getting three more of these this year in the Premier Club bundle. And this first one on its own has the value in it that I do not feel regret for purchasing Premier Club. I do not.
Oh, absolutely not.
And and this is coming from someone who is grandfathered at $5 plan. So... Yak Track, but I think this weekend I'll be getting ready for archaeology with some things to do with Hunter, because, you know, it might be kind of hard to get Maddox in the first few days, so I think I'm going to stock up on these little things called Skill Chompas.
Yep, not a bad idea.
But aside from that, Yak Track. I've done a couple of herb runs here and there, but I told everybody on Informer this week that, hey, this week's a bye week just because, you know, we got archaeology coming next week, so just take it slow, do whatever you want, and get ready for that launch. So that's what I'm doing, except for Yak Track, because that in its own provides an immense amount of energy for me. How about you in addition to Doom?
Well, I mean, honestly, I haven't done a lot in RS. I topped off the rest of the little bit that I needed of Harmonic Dust so that I will be ready for level 70 when I get there. But I've really been playing, and see, I've only really played a little, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours in Doom. I've been playing a lot of Stowe.
Star Trek Online.
Yeah. I've been playing a lot of, so,
yeah, and I think Star Trek Online is going to get an influx of players after Star Trek Picard finishes too.
And I just like I just made it to the, like, you know,
the 25th century. Yeah.
Yes, and like I'm looking for a Taylor, and then 7 and 9 runs out. I'm like, ah, 7. Like, you know, the badass. Like, she was so badass in Picard.
Yeah, and there's more of her in that game too, so it's definitely something that's all there. So I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah, very much.
All righty. Well, that wraps up this episode of RSBNB Update. We'll be back next week with all the archaeology coverage that you could imagine. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that little dive into the lore. We meant to take 25 to 30 minutes, but it's closer to 40, but I think that's okay because it's lore. And this puts this episode at the standard length for a quest week, so I am I am okay with that. And I'll just say that if you guys want to subscribe to the podcast, you can do that on any number of podcast listeners out there. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Google Podcasts. That's a new one on there. We got a link up there on the subscribe page. Spotify, Pocket Cast, YouTube, anything under the sun. update.rsbnb.com/subscribe. And of course, join our friends chat if you want to chat with people while you're playing archaeology next week. That is Bits Bytes. We'll see you guys next week on the other side for the first new skill since 2016's invention. Have fun, everyone.
See ya.